This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to Africa News Tonight. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mukbil Yabaro, filling in for Yahya Swahib, and here's what's coming up.
There's very little, if any, difference between the positions adopted by the big parties, so I don't think there'll be much of a change.
That's Anand Menon, Professor of International Politics at King's College London, on whether today's British elections are likely to lead to major policy shifts. Also, 25 soldiers have been sentenced to death in the DRC for fleeing battles against M23 rebels and theft. And Kenyan police were patrolling the streets of the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, yesterday. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Britain is holding a general election today, with polls suggesting the country is likely to elect a new leader. How might that change Britain's stance on key issues like Russia's war on Ukraine? Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
Dartford, east of London, is a bellwether constituency. Its voters have picked a candidate from the winning party of every general election since 1964. So it's a useful gauge of national feeling. There is dissatisfaction after 14 years of conservative rule, but little enthusiasm for alternatives. 19-year-old Yasmin Nichols volunteers at a local charity.
The people of England don't actually get to decide on what is going to happen in the country.
Dartford pensioner Hilmi Hilmi agrees.
Right across the board, I don't trust any of them anymore, especially when our Prime Minister Boris Johnson lied.
Boris Johnson, who resigned following a series of scandals, including the breaking of COVID-19 lockdown rules, is one of five different Conservative prime ministers over the past eight turbulent years. Analysts say current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is struggling to shake off that legacy. Political analyst Ursula Hackett of Royal Holloway, University of London.
The question there is the cost of living. But I also think it's a sense of scandal and sleaze.
The opposition Labour Party under Keir Starmer is some 20 percentage points ahead in most polls. But Starmer would inherit a weak economy, according to Anand Menon, Professor of International Politics at King's College London.
So one of the first big questions to face a Starmer government is going to be, how are you going to raise the money to fix our crumbling public services?
Amid Russia's war on Ukraine, conflict in the Middle East and global political uncertainty, would Starmer lead Britain in a new direction? Again, Anand Menon.
Over the two big crises of our time, Gaza and Ukraine, there's very little, if any, difference between the positions adopted by the big parties, so I don't think there'll be much of a change.
Britain's smaller parties could play a big role in deciding the outcome. The centre-left Liberal Democrats have a chance of pushing the Conservatives into third place. The anti-immigration, pro-Brexit Reform Party could also peel off right-leaning Conservative voters. Reform leader Nigel Farage has been widely criticised by other parties after saying the West provoked Russia into invading Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
In Senegal, France's military presence is shrinking. Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko says the country's wish to determine its path was incompatible with the entrenched presence of foreign military bases, but he did not call into question bilateral defense arrangements. Chad, ruled by Mohamed Idriss Deby, is the last Sahel country to host French soldiers. It is surrounded by the Central African Republic, Sudan, Libya, and Niger, that hosts Russian paramilitary forces resulting from the reorganization of the Wagner Group. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I think what's most important is that the Senegal case provides an alternative to how democratic governments negotiate the presence of foreign bases and manage these processes in ways that are mutually beneficial. You know, French troops are in Senegal based on existing security cooperation agreement. And if a democratically elected government in Senegal has now determined that it has developed sufficient defense and security capacities that it no longer needs to keep the French troops there, then it will renegotiate that relationship in a transparent manner and in line with its interests. And so this is very different than the way we've seen the process handled in the Sahelian countries. Let's remember, in the Sahelian countries, it wasn't just that these juntas pushed out the French, but they also pushed away the G5, ECOWAS, the United Nations, the EU. And so, you know, it really created an incongruent situation where the juntas were pushing away security partners all the while that the security situation was rapidly deteriorating. And so it really begs the question about how these decisions were taken by an elected leader's opaque process. And it's hard to see how these benefit ordinary citizens in these countries.
The French base in Djibouti, which is home to 1,500 French troops, will not be affected by the French downsizing, as France wants to retain a foothold in the small country located at the mouth of the Red Sea. However, Russia is also getting a logistic base near Port Sudan in exchange for arms to the embattled Sudanese army. What's your take on that?
I think the decision to keep troops in Djibouti is part of a broader strategic calculation. It isn't directly linked to the Russians' effort to gain a naval base access in Port Sudan. Djibouti's a strategically located country on the Strait of Bab el-Mandab. So you have, you know, critical levels of international trade and port traffic passing through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. And so it's not just the French, but the United States, China, Japan, other countries have bases in and around Djibouti. Other international actors participate in maritime exercises in the Gulf of Aden and Red Sea. And as we've seen with the Houthi attacks on the shipping through the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, with scenes with the Somali piracy activities, this is a contested area. And there's actually growing attention to provide more security to what's seen as a major artery to the global economy. And so I think that's probably the major reason why we continue to see the robust French troop presence in Djibouti.
Chad, ruled by Mohamed Idriss Deby, is the last Sahel country to host French soldiers. Chad is surrounded by the Central African Republic, Sudan, Libya, and Niger that host Russian paramilitary forces, resulting from the reorganization of Wagner Group into Africa Corps. Would that base compensate for the French reduction of forces in the region?
Chad and France have long-standing security ties, and both have seen advantages in maintaining this security relationship. I wouldn't say that it's a substitute for what French forces were doing in the Western Sahel, where they were actively engaged in trying to address the deteriorating security situation there. And so while Mohamed Deby cannot be considered a democratic leader, France's position in Chad is consistent with their new posture of only staying in places where they are welcomed. We need to be careful about drawing false equivalences with what Russia is doing in the region. You know, Russia's troops in Libya and Sudan, and to some extent, Central African Republic, are seen as actually contributing to the instability in the region and pursuing Russia's own ulterior motives. And this, in fact, is putting more pressure on Chad. And so I think these are some of the calculations that Mohamed Deby is having to calculate as he navigates his relationship with France vis-a-vis Russia.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. South Africa could lose billions of dollars in international climate financing because of a recent government decision to extend the lives of the country's coal-burning power stations. President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration says South Africa's electricity grid could collapse if it doesn't carry on burning coal to generate power well into the future. Darren Taylor reports.
It was one of the few highlights of the COP26 climate talks in Glasgow in 2021 and hailed as a blueprint for the world. The United States, European Union, the United Kingdom, France and Germany promised to give South Africa $8.5 billion to help it to stop burning coal. This fossil fuel emits harmful gases that contribute to global warming. South Africa's the seventh largest exporter of coal and one of the most coal-dependent nations on Earth. By accepting the funding to phase coal out, the South African government agreed to gradually shut its 15 coal-fired power stations by 2036, replacing them with a renewable energy sector that included wind turbines and solar farms. Africa's most industrialized country became the poster child for the global energy transition. Now, however, say activists, that poster is in tatters, with the government saying it'll keep using coal as the country's main power source, probably well beyond the agreed-upon 15-year limit. Electricity and Energy Minister Dr. Koshientjo Ramakgopa recently told reporters in Cape Town his department had no choice but to renege on its 2021 pledge.
The perennial underinvestment by municipalities in the distribution infrastructure will lead us to a situation where the infrastructure collapses. So today, as I speak to you, there are many communities that are experiencing hours in a day without electricity as a result of what they call load reduction. That is the incapacity of the distribution infrastructure to meet the demand.
The minister says the only way to meet demand for electricity in South Africa is to keep coal-burning power plants operating at high capacity. But he adds, this doesn't mean his department's plan to move toward clean energy is scrapped.
We are going to be ultra-aggressive in the rollout of renewable generation capacity. We must signal to the market our intention to transition to cleaner sources. But we are going to maintain, if you like, the spine of energy generation in the country. Coal, hydro, and we know that nuclear program, the build program, we are proceeding, and the repurposing of the coal-fired power station, gas to power, is important.
Independent energy expert Clyde Mallinson says it's possible for South Africa to stick to its commitment to decommission coal power plants by 2036, and thereby to secure the funds promised by the US and others.
I actually, in this particular instance, agree with the minister that right here, right now, we shouldn't shut them down if they are still able to safely operate, but we shouldn't be looking to run them for beyond when we meant to actually finally shut them down, if that makes sense. So a slowing down of the shutdown and then an acceleration of the shutdown where we use the time when they can produce some energy now to do what we should have been doing for the last 5 years, building replacement.
Ramakgopa says his department is in talks with private energy firms aimed at concluding deals to build renewable energy projects. These contracts, he says, once they're finalized, will hopefully be enough to convince donors not to cancel the funds they promised South Africa 3 years ago. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
25 soldiers have been sentenced to death by a military tribunal in the Democratic Republic of Congo for fleeing battles against M23 rebels and theft. Reuters reports that on Tuesday, the army detained 27 soldiers after they abandoned their positions in the villages of Kisege and Matembe in the North Kivu province. An army spokesman said the runaways were found stealing goods from shops in the nearby village of Alimbongo. They were detained along with four of their wives who were staying in the village and received the looted goods. A military tribunal was set up in Alimbongo on Wednesday, and the magistrate sentenced 25 to death for theft, fleeing the enemy, and violating orders, among other charges. One soldier was sentenced to 10 years in prison, while the four wives and another soldier were acquitted. One of the 25 pleaded guilty while the rest denied the charges. Their lawyer, Jules Mouvweko, said he would appeal the verdict. Congo's army has been fighting the Rwandan-backed M23 insurgency for more than 2 years, as well as facing other militia violence with around 2.7 million people displaced within the North Kivu province. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Mukbil Yabaro here in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, please check out voanews.com. Kenyan police were patrolling the streets of the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, yesterday. The group, first UN-backed contingent of foreign police in the country, arrived in Haiti in June, about 2 years after the Caribbean country urgently requested help to quell a surge of gang violence. Criminal gangs currently control about 80% of the capital. According to a recent report by the UN's International Organization for Migration, the upsurge of violence in Haiti has left more than 580,000 displaced in recent months. After traveling around the world for a year, Asimi Okano, a Japanese teacher, settled in Uganda to start a cocoa and vanilla farming business. This is where she met her husband, Yoshitu Asai, in 2013. They got married and had two children, both born in Uganda. VOA's Halima Othomani and Mukasa Francis met the couple and have this story from Kayunga District in central Uganda. It's part of our series dedicated to the international diaspora.
Asami Okano is a hands-on boss at the Farm of Africa, a business she started with her husband, Yoshitu Asai, in the Kayunga District of central Uganda. Most of this land is still in bush areas, but slowly being sold off to private owners like Yoshitu and Asami. As a result, very little land is left for farmers to grow food for consumption.
Uganda has good environment, many trees and many greenery, but every year they destroy the forest and they open the land, but we can understand they need to grow and to eat. So that's why cocoa and vanilla as agroforestry, also it's good for environment. They can get money and also they get matoke.
Asami says as a student, she was interested to learn about developing countries, especially Asia and Africa. So during her year-long tour, which took her to different countries, she arrived in Uganda and landed a job as a volunteer at an orphanage. She worked there for a year before the orphanage closed for lack of funding. Still in Uganda, Asami researched other ways to earn a living and discovered farming as a viable option. She decided to follow that path and settle down in Uganda. Yoshitu moved to Uganda as a backpacker, doing his own research in agriculture while also looking for a job there. Along the way, Yoshitu met Asami, started working for her before both decided to get married and settle down in Uganda. Yoshitu says what he especially loves about the country is its people and weather.
Through the year, the 25-20 degrees, so you can live with half shirts. You don't have to wear a big jacket or you don't have to become naked, so it's perfect weather. Then also, people are friendly. If I get some, I need some help, I ask someone who is passing the road, then always people can help. So I love living here.
But life in Uganda comes with its own challenges. Moreover, Asami says they had to adjust to cultural differences, particularly very different attitude towards punctuality and time management. They also had to learn the local language, Luganda.
Yeah, jewari kusebo, tanso kuraba, jewari kunyabo. Yeah, like this. Yeah, not fluent, but I can negotiate with the border also by Luganda.
At their 50-acre piece of land, the Japanese couple mainly grow cocoa, vanilla, and a few banana plants to feed their 50 farm workers, who are mostly from the neighboring community in Kayunga. Abasarita is one of them and works as a processing manager at the Farm of Africa.
Sometimes when they are coming, they bring for them some stuff like maybe clothes, toys for kids, and some other eats. And also at our farm, We have matoke, they planted matoke, and they sell it at a reduced price. So it's easier for them to come and work, and they take matoke. They are the best people I've ever seen, I think, because we do interact very well, we do cooperate very well, as long as you do your work in time.
Life is busy and hectic for the farming couple, as Asami travels frequently for business-related trips, while they both work hard to expand their business, exporting products to Japan and the United States. As a result, visits to their home country are rare and difficult. But Asami and Yoshito make sure to keep in touch with their relatives and friends back home through weekly phone calls. They say that even after 11 years in Uganda, they feel they are just getting started. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kayunga, Uganda.
The first debate of the 2024 presidential election is in the history books, but the question 1 week later is whether President Joe Biden will remain in the race after a weak performance that has raised questions within his own party about his age and mental fitness to lead. Meanwhile, his opponent Donald Trump is focusing his energy on Biden's shaky performance. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti takes a look.
The optics? Two elderly men sniping at each other in the first presidential debate. The overwhelming impression is that President Joe Biden, at 81, stumbled, and at times was difficult to understand or follow. At one point, Biden said, "I'm going to continue to move until we get the total ban on the total initiative relative to what we're going to do with more border patrol and more asylum officers." At which point, Trump responded, "I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence. I don't think he knows what he said either." Now U.S. Representative Lloyd Doggett of Texas is the first Democrat to state publicly that Biden should withdraw from the race. Analysts say that changes the dynamic. Thomas Schwartz, a political historian at Vanderbilt University, spoke on Zoom.
If I had to gamble now, I'd say it's 50-50 more than anything that Biden will not be on the ticket.
Not if the president has anything to do with it. He admits to aging, but points to his competitors' false debate claims.
"I don't speak as smoothly as I used to. I don't debate as well as I used to. But I know what I do know. I know how to tell the truth."
However, a CNN poll shows 3 out of 4 voters say Democrats have a better chance of winning the presidency without Biden as the party's nominee. Historically, losing the first debate doesn't necessarily doom a presidency.
A trend, but what it did do is to...
In 2012, analysts say then-President Barack Obama had a weak debate performance. But then he went on to win re-election. Again, Schwartz.
The reason for the bad first debate was, in Obama's case, he just wasn't as prepared. But he the next debate came up fairly quickly, and he did very well in that. Not exactly the same thing.
In another poor debate performance.
Pays for pay and salary, or pay and pension.
President Ronald Reagan appeared confused at age 73. John Fournier is with the American Enterprise Institute.
Was really at the first debate thought of as not performing well for his age, and came back and had a good second debate. So there's a short-term strategy to shore up the base, and a longer-term strategy to really show that this was an aberration and that he is able to act more vigorously and more presidential.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump has tried to keep the focus on last week's debate.
"Joe Biden spent the entire week at Camp David resting, working, studying. He studied very hard. He studied so hard that he didn't know what the hell he was doing."
Analysts say whether President Biden steps aside depends on his support in the Democratic Party and whether there are more public calls for him to resign from the race. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
Today is the 4th of July holiday weekend in the United States, and the 4-day break is expected to create new travel records. The Transportation Security Administration predicts that its officers will screen more than 3 million travelers at U.S. airports on Sunday, when people will be heading home from the holiday, breaking the record of just under 3 million set on June 23rd. Auto Club AAA predicts that the holiday travel will be 5% higher than it was last summer. Of the nearly 71 million people, AAA expects to travel at least 80 kilometers from home over a 9-day stretch that began June 27th. Most of them are driving. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mukbil Yabaro, filling in for Yahyaeus Wahib here in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Dave Vandy, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.